very specialized subject that we are going to talk about tonight. I think some of you might even have not heard the word jhana. Perhaps these our young friends who just appeared here this evening may be tired and bored by listening to this talk. And yet, this may plant the seed of wisdom in their later years. So still they will, even they will be benefited. We have been talking about jhanas. We started yesterday and I gave an outline of jhanas. Today I want to start with the contextual reference to jhanas. Where does jhana occur? In which part of the Buddha's teaching? How important it is for understanding the Dhamma, the teachings of the Buddha, when we learn jhanas. For this reason, I have got this little chart which show step by step a teaching of the Buddha. And when we come to the point where the jhana is mentioned, I will show you the connection between the rest of the teaching and jhanas. So we turn the... Okay. I'm pretty sure you all are familiar with this. I don't think there is one in this group except this, perhaps that little one, who has not read or heard of these things. This is what is called the Noble Eightfold Path, which sometimes is called the Middle Path of the Buddha. And this is the fourth noble truth. Of four noble truths, this is the fourth. The path leading to the end of suffering. And here we have understanding. Understanding of suffering, dukkha, origin of it. Understanding the end of dukkha and understanding the way leading to the end of dukkha. The way leading to the end of dukkha, or dukkha is suffering, is the title here, Noble Eightfold Path. So, understanding the Four Noble Truths is part of the Noble Eightfold Path. So these two, Noble Eightfold Path and understanding the Four Noble Truths, are one and the same thing. And in that we have next step of the Noble. Now we are going through the steps of the Noble Eightfold Path. The first is understanding. And in that understanding, we got to understand the Noble Eightfold Path itself. And we got to understand the Four Noble Truths itself. In the Noble Eightfold Path, number two, his right intention, and I would advise you to commit to your memory this second step, that is intention. Intention, sometimes we call right thought. And this is what yesterday I mentioned as right sankappa or vitakka, the thought, initial application of thought, sustained application of thought. Remember, yesterday I mentioned. And the initial application of thought or sustained application of thought refer to this second step of the Noble Eightfold Path. That means, yesterday also I showed you, not in writing but in my talk, the attainment of the first jhana. I mentioned that. There I said, the first time the thought of renunciation, goodwill, compassion arise in more strong way and keep leave the deep impact impression in the mind at the attainment of the first jhana. And this is called renunciation, is the thought of renunciation. Thought of renunciation means thought of letting go of our craving. For that moment, don't be alarmed that you have to give up everything to attain jhanas. Give up your family, your bank account, your account, your jobs and everything. But for that moment, that instant, when you are going to gain concentration, you've got to deliberately, even unwillingly, let go of your attachment to anything, drop them. That is called renunciation. Generally, people understand the word renunciation to mean leaving home and going to monastery, shaving the head, wearing the yellow robe and staying as a monastic. That is how people understand the word renunciation. But renunciation has steps, degrees. When you try to attain jhana, you got to follow, you got to let go of something. That letting go of something is called renunciation. You renounce that greed. That is a thought. Sometimes it is called nekkhamma sankappa in Pali, or sometimes it is called nekkhamma vitakka. The word I keep, the word vitakka I keep using in order to remind you the jhana factor. Jhana factor is one of the factors in the jhanas. In this talk, in this series, I want to show you the difference between jhana, samatha and samadhi. We use these terms. We use sometimes jhana, we use sometimes samatha, sometimes we use samadhi. And I will explain all these things in turn whenever I have time. Now, at this point, just remember these three thoughts. Thought of renunciation, we call intention. The second intention is used for another reason, that is to get the wider meaning of the term. Second is the thought of goodwill as opposed to ill will. And this is what is called loving friendliness. Goodwill is called metta. So we use different terms for the same thing. Sometimes we call metta, sometimes we call goodwill, sometimes we call loving friendliness. Some people call loving kindness. So I have reason for not using the word loving kindness. Perhaps later on when you have questions, you can ask me questions. Then I explain, because I cannot go into all these details in this talk. So that is a thought. When you want to attain jhana, you got to have the thought of benevolence, thought of goodwill, not to have a scruple of obstacles. If you have anger or hatred, that would be a stumbling block. So you got to have the very smooth running mind, very peaceful, because the whole practice of jhana is what is called samatha meditation, tranquility meditation. When you are trying to tranquilize your mind, you cannot use chemicals, pills to tranquilize your mind, injections. You got to develop it within yourself. This is a mental development. This is what is called cultivation of mind. Noble Eightfold Path also is called Bhavetabha. Bhavetabha means that which is to be cultivated. And when we cultivate, we have to arouse these states of mind. There is a very beautiful statement in the Buddha stating, every statement is beautiful. But this particular statement, he said, Pabhasara midam bhikkave chittam tanchako agantuke upaklese upakkilittam tan asutava putujjano napajanati tasma asutava putujjana sa chitta bhavana nama natti. Meaning, because this mind is luminous, shining. But because of the adventitious defilements, it gets defiled. And yet, an average uneducated person does not know that. Uneducated doesn't mean the one who has not been to university or get this academic paper qualification. In his definition, we all are uneducated. We may have degrees, doctorate, PhD, and so forth. And yet, in his definition of uneducated, what is called asutava putujjana. Asutava means one who has not heard. What has he not heard? He or she has not heard and established his mind in the truth, the Four Noble Truth. So anyway, such a person does not know that mind is luminous. This luminosity doesn't mean purity. Something can be luminous and yet it will be impure, like aluminum foil. Something that shines always is not gold. So the mind can become shine. We have to polish it to make it more shine, because it has a lot of impurities. Impurities come from outside through when our senses and sensory objects come in contact, impurities will be the result if we are not mindful. When the eyes, senses and sensory objects come into contact, at that time, if he remained mindful, mindful screen, filter the defilements. The mindfulness filters the information coming into the mind and let impurities not come in to the mind. Most of the time we are not mindful, and therefore impurities can come, and defile the mind. Otherwise, mind is like a mirror. Mirror just is there to reflect objects. But when we are unmindful, that mirror becomes defiled. So anyway, Buddha said, if an educated person who knows the Dhamma, the truth, knows that the mind is shining, that person will cultivate the mind. Cultivating mind is through the cultivation of jhanas. The word luminous is used here for gaining, attaining jhanas. And therefore, when you want to attain jhanas, you got to remove this ill will, cultivate goodwill. You got to get rid of greed, which defiles the mind. Ill will defiles the mind. So we got to get rid of, temporarily, mind you, at that moment, get rid of greed, get rid of defilement. Don't let them stain your mind. Then next is compassion against cruelty. When the mind is cruel, that also defiles the mind. And these are the three thoughts that first appear in the mind in a very pure form. Thought of renunciation arises in the mind in a very pure, altruistic form. Loving friendliness arises in the mind in an altruistic form. And the compassion arises in the mind. So, therefore you got to remember, whenever we talk about the thought of initial thought, these are the initial thoughts. When we talk about sustained thought, this is a sustained thought. In our formula, I will show you the jhanic factors. And therefore, whenever we talk about jhanic factors, we got to remember these three things. That is why I use this chart now. Talking about the Noble Eightfold Path, step number 3 is speech. When we want to cultivate jhana, we have to train our words as well. That means when the mind is defiled, you cannot attain jhana. That means we have to discipline our talks. Discipline into talk is abstaining from false speech, malicious speech, harsh speech, and useless speech. Why we want to discipline them? Discipline our words? Because when you are in trying to gain jhana, these are the things that keep bugging your mind. Thought of false speech can trouble your mind, then you cannot attain jhana. The malicious speech that you have made, committed, or said something maliciously will trouble your mind. Harsh speech as well as useless speech, because you regret. When the mind is full of remorse, you cannot attain jhana. So these are the preparatory stages for attaining jhanas. And therefore, one who wants to attain jhanas must abstain from doing these things. At least at that moment, one must make a commitment, determination, not to let the mind be invaded by these speeches. Next is action. Killing, stealing, and sexual misconduct. These also trouble our mind. This is how we say we get restlessness and worry. Remember, one of the hindrances, or pair of hindrances that we talked about yesterday, are remorse, restlessness, and worry. We become restless. We will be full of worries, and that worries make us restless. We worry because we have a memory of killing, stealing, and committing sexual misconduct. When we come to meditation, we must learn to drop all these memories from our mind. That, of course, is not very easy, but somebody who has trained himself or herself for a certain period of time from abstaining from these things, train oneself to abstain from these things, would be able to drop these thoughts, memories from his mind. Next is right livelihood, avoiding wrong livelihood, living by right form of livelihood. This is also a very big part of our life. Livelihood is the thing that keeps us alive, bringing us our source of living. So that always is there to trouble our mind. After meditation, you have to go back to the same thing and do the same wrong livelihood. So we have to be very careful when we choose a job. You know, sometimes people think this practicing of jhana is not very easy for lay people. It is not that difficult for lay people if they follow these steps. Now, I want to run through this very quickly, because this course is primarily not teaching of what? I want to spend more time on the jhanas itself, but I want to show you the perspective, the spectrum of the whole teaching, and show where jhana fits in the Buddha's teaching. Number 6, 7, 8. Number 6, 7, 8. Are called bhavana, meditation, or samadhi, samma samadhi, sila, samadhi, panya. this whole section is called samadhi. Three steps. Each step has three subdivisions, four subdivisions. Effort, mindfulness, and concentration. Effort is absolutely necessary to practice jhana. And mindfulness is necessary to practice jhana. And concentration, of course, is the one of the indispensable factors of jhana. Now these three, effort, mindfulness, and concentration, becomes more effective, prominent in the practice of jhana. One effort is prevent unnecessary, unwholesome state of mind. That is, when hindrances, here we take hindrances as part of our jhana practice. I hope you all believe, you all remember hindrances, right?
Yes.
Five hindrances. What are they? Sleepiness and drowsiness, restlessness and worry, doubt, ill will, and anger, ill will and anger, and greed. These are the hindrances. Now, when we try to gain concentration, at that moment we may not have any of these hindrances. Why? Because before we come to jhana level, we have overcome hindrances. When we try to gain concentration, we first had to overcome hindrances. But they can remain temporarily subdued, weakened, and yet they can from time to time haunt our mind. Whenever they appear trying to haunt our mind, that time we must remember not to let them arise. That is what is called unarisen, unwholesome mental states. In reference to jhana, unwholesome, unarisen, unwholesome mental states particularly refers to jhanas, what you call hindrances. Second, in spite of your very sincere effort to prevent them from arising, because of their habit, all your life they have been sustained, nourished, supported. How have we nourished, sustained, and supported hindrances? What have we done to nourish hindrances? One thing we have done to nourish hindrances is that we have been unmindful. Unmindfulness is a nourishment for hindrances. Mindfulness suffocates hindrances. Mindfulness does not let hindrances breathe, so to say. So, since we have not been mindful all our life, or most of our life, we allow hindrances to grow and nourish the roots. And therefore, as a habit, when we try to cultivate, gain concentration, these hindrances, unnoticed, unwholesome hindrances can arise. And then we must make effort, deliberate effort, to get rid of these hindrances. Effort has, when we make effort, it also has three levels. One is called initial effort, that is called Arambadhatu. It is called element. Arambadhatu, meaning at first you may make effort to get rid of them. You have heard talk about getting rid of defilement, hindrances, or you might have read, you are very enthusiastic in gaining jhanas and so forth, and therefore you are motivated, encouraged, and therefore you think, let me get rid of it. But slowly you lose your initial effort. And therefore you have to apply another effort. That is called Nikkama Dhatu. That is the element of proceeding without budging, without, you know, surrendering to your defilements. You must keep on doing it again and again, encouraging yourself to continue the practice. The third effort is Parakkama Dhatu. Parakkama Dhatu means you tell yourself, let my blood dry, flesh wither, and reduce myself into skeleton, and yet I will not give up this effort. That kind of very firm commitment you have to make in order to get rid of this arisen unwholesome mental state. That means not effortless effort. As sometimes people say, make effortless effort. Because people are so lazy to make effort, so they want to lull them, you know, make them happy, satisfy. Don't worry. Make little effort. Friends, you cannot make little effort. With a little effort, you can gain only very little. With great effort, you can get something very great. Your goal is very lofty goal. For the lofty goal, you got to make a lofty sacrifice. And that is not, that cannot be achieved by making effortless effort. You got to make a very firm, you know, human effort. Purusha Thama, Purusha Virya, Purusha Parakkama, Buddha said. When I use the word Purusha, people ask, what about Itti? Purusha means man. Manly effort, manly striving. Then people ask, what about womanly effort? Here man doesn't mean actually gender. Here it simply means the strength you got to use, a definite, powerful, strong commitment to mean that the word Purusha is used. Anyway, then you have to make an effort to arouse unarisen, wholesome mental state. That is to make effort to arouse this initial application of thought, sustained application of thought, that is thought of renunciation, thought of loving friendliness, thought of compassion. Those are the wholesome mental state you get to arouse. We have to do that deliberately. Make effort to arouse that. That means let go of any kind of clinging, craving arises at that moment. Mind you always, this is temporary. This is temporary. Don't be alarmed. We are not asking people to give up everything. You know, when we ask people to give up, you don't give up everything. You give up something and keep something. You don't throw the baby with bad water. You must learn what to give up, what to keep. All unwholesome things you give up, and wholesome things you keep. Right? When we ask people to give up, we don't mean that they give up, that they should give up everything, both wholesome and unwholesome. That you will do eventually. Punya papa pahinasa natti jagrato bhayang. When you come to that level, then you give up both good and evil. But this is not that level. You are far, far short of that level. And therefore, at this level, keep your good things, wholesome things. And those are the things that give you support to go forward. And those that support you to go forward, you hold on to them, keep them. That is your provision. That is your pocket money. You keep them until you reach the top. So anyway, we make... This is why we have to have a great mindfulness to sort out what is to be kept, what is to be given up. So we make effort to arouse these wholesome things in the mind, and then make effort to maintain and perfect arisen wholesome state of mind. In this case, arisen wholesome mental states of mind are those three wholesome thoughts: renunciation, thought of renunciation, thought of loving friendliness, and thought of compassion. Then, mindfulness. You know, to practice dhyana, dhyana practice is the last one of this Noble Eightfold Path. And it is supported by seven factors, seven preceding factors support the last factor. So the sixth one is, the seventh is right mindfulness. Mindfulness of the body, feelings, consciousness, and mental states, mental objects. That is where we get vipassana. We practice vipassana, or insight, mindfulness, there. So you can see, mindfulness is not something you go to totally forget to practice jhana. You got to have mindfulness. You can see when I show you the formula, how and where mindfulness comes handy. For now, just remember, we have to practice mindfulness to gain concentration. The last is the jhanas. That is where jhana occurs. When you take a when you look at the whole thing from the top to bottom, you can see the last of the Noble Eightfold Path, last factor of the Noble Eightfold Path is right concentration, which always is defined in terms of jhanas, first, second, third, fourth. Now, that is the one we are going to talk about. And that is the one we started talking about yesterday. I want to show all these things, to show this, to come to this and show you where jhana fits in the Buddha's teaching. And therefore, the whole notion of that we don't need jhanas to attain total liberation is a wrong notion, misunderstanding. We got to follow the entire Noble Eightfold Path in order to attain jhana. Because, as I mentioned, all the preceding seven factors, seven steps of the Noble Eightfold Path enforce, reinforce, support the last one, that is the jhana. Without those seven preceding factors, attainment of jhana is not possible. I must qualify this statement a little bit. Because we are talking about right concentration. Jhana is called a practice of right concentration. All these are called right. When we say right, there must be something wrong, isn't it? So, if we talk about right concentration, there must be wrong concentration as well. So, if we want to practice right concentration, we have to follow the right method, right system. If we want to gain concentration of any kind, you don't have to worry about right things. It's just in any kind of concentration. Right concentration is defined as kusala chittasya ekaggata. Kusala chittasya ekaggata. One-pointedness of wholesome mind is called right concentration. So the mind is not always wholesome. We have to make it wholesome. Mind naturally is not wholesome. So, if you want to attain right concentration, wholesome concentration, correct concentration, we go to follow that particular method, that system. As you know, according to our mental the law of the way how the mind works, we gain concentration, we have to have concentration for gaining any knowledge. Even to study we have to have concentration. To do our work properly we have to have concentration. To study you have to have concentration. Even a thief who wants to steal, he has to have very good concentration. May not be right one, but still he has to have concentration. So concentration is there, is absolutely necessary for accomplishing anything worth attaining, worth accomplishing. But we are not talking about the concentration in general. We are talking about specific kind of concentration. That is what is called right concentration. And that is why we have to follow this method to gain right concentration. Why we want to gain right concentration? Because we want to have a right wisdom. Buddha said, sukhino chittam samadhiyati samahitam chittam yathabhutam pajanati. Samahitam chittam yathabhutam pajanati. We want to see things exactly as they are. In order to see things exactly as they are, we have to have a good concentration. when we want to see something as it is, we have to have a right concentration. When we have a wrong concentration, we may accomplish something, but we won't see things as they really are. And therefore, our whole purpose of doing this is to sharpen our mind, cleanse our mind, purify it from impurities, remove these adventitious defilements, and reach this luminous mind in order to see things as they really are. Friends, this evening, I want to talk only this much, just to show you the whole map. You see? And then, I will go step by step from first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana, for the next 3 days. Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. And I hope we will be able to cover. Now I want to pause and invite questions. Because when we go on talking like this, perhaps things may not clear in the mind, not settle in the mind. People may have all kind of doubts. In order to clarify these doubts, you have to ask questions. This is not only one-sided, work. We have to have a participation. So you got to participate in this in order to make it more clear in your mind. I can start with this while others are thinking of their questions. That gives them plenty of time to think. Okay, thank you. Okay. Please explain 5 aggregates in more detail. Five aggregates are form, feelings, perceptions, thoughts, and consciousness. These are the 5 aggregates. What are the forms? What is the form? Form is made up of elements, 4 primary elements, 4 derived elements. We all know 4 primary elements: earth, water, fire, air. Sometimes we have five elements, including space, akasa, dhatu. So anyway, we normally talk about 4 elements. What are the derived elements? Derived elements are color, smell, taste, and nutriment. All these we find in form. Form is that which occupies the space, that has appearance, that is has size, weight, color, appearance, and so forth. So we are made up of that, and all we see and all we touch all we really perceive is our form, rupa. Then we divide this form into various parts, you know, when we meditate. The form divide into 20 subdivisions, 20 parts. And the form element, that is earth element of the body, divide into 20 parts. And then water element is divided into 12 parts. Air element is divided into 6 parts, and the fire element is divided into 4 parts. Altogether, all this form divided into 40 parts, 42 parts. We normally call it 32 parts of the body, but there are 42. 32 include only 2 elements, earth element and water element. And when we take the other 2 elements, we add another 10 to make it 42 elements. All these we call form. One of the 5 aggregates. And then form is visible, tangible, and so forth. A big, perceptible. And there are 4 other aggregates, invisible. Visible element, visible aggregate is 1. Invisible aggregates are 4. They are called feeling. We can't see feeling. Then perceptions, thoughts, and consciousness. So the body and mind divided into these five groups, and then we divide the 5 groups into 2, I mean put into 2 categories as body and mind, nama rupa. Rupa is 1, nama is divided into 4. Now, these 5 aggregates are called aggregates of suffering, dukkha khanda. Khanda means aggregate. Rupa khanda, Vedana khanda, Sanya khanda, Sankhara khanda, Vinyana khanda. Rupa form aggregate, feeling aggregate, perception aggregate, consciousness aggregate, and mental formation aggregate. But all of them put together and called, give one label, that is dukkha khanda. Aggregate of suffering. So, when we use this more elaborately in our practice of meditation, so the 5 aggregates is part of our meditation, especially when we come to Mahasatipatthana Sutta, the manual of Vipassana meditation, and Dhamma Vipassana, reflection of or mindfulness of Dhamma, 5 aggregates are used as a part of our mental objects. So, you can see what the 5 aggregates are. Next question is, please describe the exact technique of vipassana meditation. That also is a very important question. In fact, our meditation, whole meditation practice divides into samatha and vipassana. The one I was explaining in trying to talk about jhana is samatha meditation. But from time to time, I mention vipassana as well. And therefore your question also actually is quite pertinent to this discussion. The next question also is, please explain the process of vipassana meditation and how it leads to insight. This question is, please discuss the exact technique of vipassana meditation. Both seem to be related questions. Now, let us take the five aggregates, because for vipassana meditation, for samatha meditation, we can sometimes use external objects. Sometimes, I did not go into that, you know, fuzziness and, you know, light and color and so forth. For vipassana meditation, we don't use anything external. We all come inside. Look at our five aggregates. Form, aggregate of form, F-O-R-M, when we practice vipassana, F-O-R-M appear to us, F-O-A-M, form. Although it looks very big, appears to be big, when we mindfully pay total, undivided, concentrated attention to the form, this form is not that big. It is such a... mentally we can bring it down to invisible, almost indivisible level with the concentrated mind. Until we see that level, we don't see the very intrinsic nature of this body. We intuitively or logically, inferentially, we may think that the body, that we know the intrinsic nature of the body. But we don't see that. We see the intrinsic nature of the body only when we gain concentration and focus that concentrated mind on each and every tiny, minute part of our body. What do we see? What do you see when you put tiny little part of your body under microscope? It is not static. It is always acting, always in action, motion. Not one single iota of this body remains static under microscope. The Buddha's vision, knowledge, understanding of this body is so sharp and deep and powerful. He said thousands of years before microscope was introduced, he said, this body is in the state of flux. It goes upada moment, thiti moment, bhanga moment, rising moment, reaching the peak moment and passing away moment. These three moments happen so quickly, in such an inconceivable rapidity they change, that you cannot see the change with your naked eyes. But only with deep, that is why we need this jhanic meditation first. We must understand what that is in order to practice vipassana more meaningfully, more profitably, more successfully. So when we practice vipassana, what we see, number one, is this intrinsic nature of each and every tiny, minute cell, atomic, subatomic, molecules level of our body. The intrinsic nature, intrinsic means that it is native to that particular thing. It is inside in that particular thing. And that intrinsic nature is that it is impermanent. You can never pinpoint the present moment in our body. Because even the present moment is disappearing so quickly. Now, we cannot see this with our eyes. When we open our eyes, we cannot see. So we have to close our eyes. Like a platypus. You know, platypus is an animal living in Tasmania. This animal has some special device on its nose. His beak is like a duck's beak. And it has a special device which activates only when he closes his eyes. When he is approaching a prey from a distance, as soon as he saw the prey, focusing his bill towards the animal, he closes his eyes. Then there is an electronic device, you know, on his beak, which activates and sends electric, current, which stuns the animal. Then he approaches and catches the animal. But as long as he keeps his eyes open, this doesn't work. Similarly, when we practice vipassana meditation, don't open your eyes. You never see yourself well. Close your eyes. Focus your concentrated mind on not outside, but inside. Sometimes people say this, inside meditation. Because we use inside, bring inside out. So we saw inside meditation is the meditation that we use to see us exactly as we are without prejudice and bias. And that's why we need concentration, because when we practice concentration, one more factor will come to our, become active in our mind. That is the factor called equanimity, upekkha. We will talk about all these factors later on, but I just want to show, you know, some of the things that involve in the practice of vipassana. Feeling, form is like a form. Feeling is like bubble. Buddha called Vedana Bubbulupama. Bubble means bubbula in Pali. Bubbula. Feeling is bubbling all the time. Appearing and disappearing. All the time. We cannot see that. But we can feel it. We can feel more clearly and sharply only when mind gains concentration and focus that concentrated mind on every tiny little feeling we have. You got to do that in order to understand it. By listening to the talk, you may not realize it. Then, perception is like mirage. Marichikupama sanya. Sanya is perception. Like mirage. From a distance you can see mirage, and even a shadow of a vehicle going in that area. But when you approach, there is no water. Then sankhara. I have a lot of things to say about sankhara, but I don't have time to talk about them. Sankhara is our backpack for sansara journey. The bigger the backpack, the longer we go, and the bigger the backpack, heavier it is. So this sansara backpack, we have sankhara. Wholesome sankhara, unwholesome sankhara, imperturbable sankharas. Sankharas means that which arises from causes and conditions. And these sankharas I compare to onion. You spell onion on and on with I in the middle. Because of the I in the middle, you go on and on and on and on. So, it also confuses you, because from outside you think onion has a core in it. If you keep peeling onion each layer, in the center, there is no core. But it gives you the perception that it has a core in it. Similarly, when you peel off the sankhara, inside there is nothing. But because of the powerful I, we accumulate the sankharas and keep going on and on and on. You don't find this in text, but I made this in the text. You see sankhara kadalupama compared to banana, plantain, trees. But I think this onion is very profound. It's very meaningful. I have another thing to say about this sankhara. I hold on to it, and some other time I say, because too many things you may forget everything. What?
You want it to say now, you want to hear that.
No.
You made us curious now.
No, next time. So you will come next time. I will tell you something even better. Better than this one. Very interesting. So we go to the next one. What is called vijnana. That is called consciousness. Consciousness is like magic. magicians perform all kind of magics. But in reality, what they do is they trick you. They trick you to believe something real. But in reality, they are so smart, they can do things so fast that makes you believe that it is real. Suppose there is a screen and the magician is behind the screen. Audience are in front. So you go behind the screen, behind the wall, and you drill a little hole. And and you watch what the magician does behind the screen. He will take a stick like this, break into two, and pass it on to people on two different directions. This one, he gives one piece here, and he gives the other piece to that side people, and they all see these two pieces. And then he collects these two pieces. And while you are watching, hold these two pieces and blow. It becomes one. Then he shows one piece. But you, one of you, sitting behind the wall, looking through the hole, can see what he does. He has two sticks. He breaks only one, other he hides his under his sleeves. And he dropped this one very quickly and showed this one. He has to be very smart, very quick. So you see all this, taking a cap, showing to the people, empty cap, empty hand. But while you are watching, he puts his hand in and take a pigeon out of it. But you saw that he has a special pocket in it, and he has hidden a pigeon there. And he managed to take it out so quickly that you will never believe that there was a pigeon in it. So you saw all these things from behind the wall. So after the magic show, when the magic show is going on, people are clapping and tapping and booing and, you know, laughing and giggling and all these things. When everything is over, you come out of your hiding. And your friend may be sitting in the audience. Your friend asks you, where have you been? Didn't you see magic? You would say, there is no magic. Then your friend says, gee, my poor friend, we all saw magic. He is so deluded, he did not see magic. In this situation, who is deluded? You or the audience? You think, see, these people are so large number of people, so confused, so deluded, that they thought there was something real, but I saw the reality. Consciousness is like that. Consciousness can deceive us, trick us to believe in something. That is why there are two statements in the Majjhima Nikaya Sutra, one Alagadrupama Sutra, where Aritha, the other one is Sati, believe that it is the same consciousness that goes from life to life. But the consciousness is so powerful, so subtle, so quick, that one can not see the consciousness is conditionally arisen mental state. It does not exist there. It exists only when the conditions, causes and conditions come together. And it happens so quickly that it gives an impression that it's something going on and on permanently. The notion of self, notion of permanency, is because of not seeing the swiftness, quickness of this consciousness, because it is so powerful. So when we develop our mind concentration, with the powerful concentrated mind, I will say more about this powerful concentration later on. More powerful concentrated mind, we can see these things happening so fast, arising moment keep arising all the time. So our Hindu friends say, creator. His job is creating. Creating, never stops. Then comes another deity called preserver. He preserves. His job is trying to preserve what is created. Then comes the third to destroy, Shiva. So they put this Upada Thiti Bhanga, rising moment, peak moment, passing away moment, into three deities. One deity is the creator. That deity never stops creating. The second deity is Vishnu, trying to preserve. He is fighting, losing battle all the time, because he can never preserve what is created. And the Shiva is the winner. He destroys. And if every moment things are created, next moment it's gone. So Hindus are very smart. They put this in a more mythological, more tangible terms, so that average people can relate. They can relate. We put it in such an abstract way, not average people can relate. So, anyway, you think about it. You have any more questions? Yes.
Bhante, how can you tell when you see things as they are? Because one person would say, this is how it is, and you think that's the way it is. Another person would say, no, that's not the way it is. How do you know when you're seeing things?
You know,
as they are?
That is a relative, conventional truth. Relative truth, conventional truth, vary from place to place, time to time, person to person. We are talking about the eternal truth, which will not change. You bring me anything that does not change, I bet you will never find anything that does not change. And that is why the Buddha said, Uppadava bhikkhave tathagatanam, anuppadava tathagatanam, titava sa dhatu dhamma titata dhamma niyamata sabbe dhamma anicchati tan tathagato abhisambujyati abhisameti abhisambujyitva abhisamitva achikkati deseti panyapeti pattepeti vivarati vibhajati uttani karoti. He said because whether the Buddhas come into existence or not, this established element of truth exists. What is the established element of truth? Titava dhatu dhamma titata. Dhamma dhatu. The element of truth. What is that? That sabbe sankhara anicca. All conditional things are impermanent. They are impermanent. Whether the Buddhas come, Buddhas don't have to come to make things impermanent. Nobody can come into the world to make them permanent.
So then, the way things are, truth, is really another word for impermanence.
Impermanence.
Yeah.
Impermanence. So, then Buddha said, Tantathagato abhisambhujyati. The Buddha understand, realize this. Abhisameti. See clearly, abhisambhujyato abhisamitva atikkati deseti panyapeti pattapeti vivarati vivajati uttani karoti. He explain, expound, describe, point out, and advise people to understand this intrinsic nature of all conditional things. You know, we ask you to sharpen your knife to cut something. You never want to sharpen the knife. With a blunt knife you try to cut. You can never cut it. So in order to see this, we got to follow the steps and clear the mind, gain concentration, and use that concentration to focus the mind on that, on anything we want to see. You know, vipassana means seeing things as they really are. Seeing things in a very special way to see them as they really are. See things here means the five aggregates. Not anything outside, but things inside. All our misunderstanding, all our confusions, all our conflicts, we can go on and on, and there is nothing in the world which is not related to our five aggregates. War in Iraq, it happened thousands of miles away, related to our five aggregates. You may not think about it. The whole economic situation, the whole world, related to our five aggregates. You bring anything in the universe that is not related to our five aggregates, I'll be surprised. Everything is related to our own five aggregates. And therefore, we have to focus our mind to see the way how the five aggregates work. Then we understand the whole universe, whole world. I think, friends, if you have any more questions, yes?
This relationship with the, or everything with our five aggregates is due to attachment?
Due to attachment and ignorance.
You mentioned consciousness as being a magician. Would you be willing to elaborate, when you use the word consciousness, what exactly do you mean?
I think that's a good question. She asked me, how do I define consciousness? Right?
Correct.
What do I mean by consciousness?
Correct.
Consciousness is that which arises dependent upon senses and sensory objects. That mental state that arises dependent upon senses, the contact between senses and sensory objects. Now, consciousness is not something that exists all the time. The mental state that arises because of these causes and conditions. And that is why it is impermanent.
Okay, so maybe help me understand this, because my struggle with that is that from the Hindu perspective, there is that substratum that is, as we said, the eternal truth. That has been almost used synonymously, according to my understanding of it, as consciousness. Yet what I'm hearing from you is that the way you're using the word consciousness is not that eternal substratum.
Not eternal. Not eternal. Nothing in this aggregate is eternal. But you know, when we say something eternal, we fall into eternalism, that is sasatavada. If we say something is something disappears as soon as we die, we fall into uchedavada, that is nihilism. So this teaching is neither eternalistic nor nihilistic, but realistic. It happens now, and it is realizable. It happens because of many, many, many variable causes and conditions. And all these causes and conditions themselves are conditioned by some other causes and conditions. The whole existence is a network of causes and conditions, not existing anything singly by itself. Therefore, within that system, not one single entity can exist eternally.
So in this matrix of causes and effects, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Which is supported by ignorance and greed?
No. Causes and conditions all are not supported by greed and ignorance. Greed and what do you call ignorance.
Okay.
Because greed and ignorance themselves have their own causes and conditions.
Correct.
And if we say greed and ignorance conditions are the causes and effects, then we conclude or we imply that causes and what you call greed and ignorance are the basis of all this. They are basis of our existence, but they themselves are subject to the same law of impermanence.
So according to the Buddha's teachings, what is behind or underneath or the substratum of this cause and effect?
There is no one single substratum.
Correct.
To support all of them, because each of them exists dependent upon others. There's no anything outside or inside beside these causes and conditions for their survival.
So therefore that's the nothingness that he referred to.
You know, when you make that conclusion, that also is not correct.
No one let me get away with it.
I have a question.
Yeah. Dhamma anupassana, mindfulness of Dhamma. Mindfulness of Dhamma in that discourse, the way how various mental states operate, like even hindrances I mentioned there, we become mindful of how hindrances are Dhamma. When we use the word Dhamma, that is another difficult term to translate. In this case, phenomenon, we may say phenomenon, mental phenomenon. When we focus our mind on mental phenomenon, we see how certain mental phenomenon arises dependent upon other factors, like when hindrances, for example, how hindrances arise. Hindrances arise dependent upon what you call three unwholesome behavior: thoughts, words, deeds. And since they also depend on some other factors, so the mind begins to see the way how they arise, and then mind realizes this dependent arising of various mental phenomena. I mean, this is to give you one example. So, seeing this mental activities is called seeing or becoming mindful of Dhamma. There are five categories of things to discuss. Each of them is a very, we have to go into very minute details of all of them. So from this little example, perhaps you may be able to understand what the mindfulness of Dhamma means. That means we become mindful of the way how this phenomenon, mental phenomenon, occurs. Okay?
And is it that way, Pattarana Vivarane?
Pattarana?
Yeah.
Yes, Pattarana is a very profound, deep description of. Detailed description of how mental phenomenon work.
Friend, we'll have to end this evening session here. If you have any more questions, there is a question box outside. So if you write your questions, and then we can start with those questions tomorrow. For the next little while, just so we can center ourselves before we leave again, we'll have a short meditation, and then we'll close for the evening.
Another 15 minutes?
Yes,
I think longer better. But I don't know how long you can meditate. Shall we meditate for about half an hour?